offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Try on Pilgrimage. This is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and I'm happy to come to you live, as always, from our studios at the Sri Satya Sai Media Center, Prashanthi Nilayam. It's the eve of Christmas. It's a very holy day, and for the many, many years that we've spent in Swami's presence, Swami has permitted us to celebrate and observe this beautiful festival in the true sense that it must be, remembering, recalling, and committing ourselves again to the message that Jesus Christ stood for. So I find it my pleasure to join you all on this beautiful Christmas Eve. We are going through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse, and we are in the 8th chapter. And we are in that portion of the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna is explaining the immensity of the spiritual goal that he is inspiring each one of us to follow. How grand is this final liberation, or meeting the Lord, or joining the Lord, or merging in the Lord, or however you'd like to put it, communion, sayujyam, kaivalyam, mukti, moksha, you might call it anyway. Of course, in scriptural parlance, sometimes these words may have specific meanings and may be different from each other, but the ultimate state that we are talking of is when one reaches the Lord. And Krishna is going to be speaking, he has been speaking about how immense a thing this is that he is asking Arjuna to strive for. And nothing is even close in comparison when you put it in, when you juxtapose it to this grand achievement. So we will go back to what we were doing last week. I'll give you a quick summary before we head to what the shlokas that we are going to be discussing this week. We covered three verses from the 8th chapter, 14, 15 and 16. And this particular portion comes from Krishna describing the yogic way of giving up the body, after having said that one who thinks of me when the final journey begins, reaches me. This portion, these three shlokas and probably a shloka before that, where Krishna was talking about the yogic way of giving up life, if I could put it that way. And to be honest, it was a bit technical and kind of overwhelming too. A lot of things to keep in mind, especially in the last moments, that seemed to be a little overwhelming and a tall order, right? But the 14th shloka is a very reassuring one, where almost it is like Krishna saying, after having given all those descriptions, but don't worry about all this, all you have to do is only this much. And what is that he says? Ananya chetaha satatam yomam smarati nityashaha. Without other thoughts, he who constantly thinks of me always, tasya nitya yuktasya yoginaha, for such an ever steadfast yogi, aham sulabaha, I am easy to attain. You think all this is very complex, but Krishna says, but if you think of me at all times without break, incessantly, I am easy to attain, aham sulabaha. We also went through the portion where in Gita Vahini Swami says, if as a devotee you say, this is also too much to ask of me, it is too much for me to do, then Swami says it only means that you consider liberation as being very cheap and you are not giving it its due importance. Swami also goes on to say that I have given you the required strength. Right now you use that strength, that resilience, that perseverance to pursue the world. All I'm saying is that it must be diverted towards God. That's what Swami said in those portions that we simultaneously and in parallel discussing in the Gita Vahini. In the 15th verse, Krishna reiterates the significance of reaching him. The whole idea is about that. For such Mahatmas, he says, there is no return to this life of sorrow and impermanence. Return to this life, which is the abode of all sorrow and impermanence. Punarjanma dukkhalayam ashashvatam na apnuvanti mahatmanah. In this context, we went through what is said in the Garbhopanishad, right? How at the time of birth, the Jivatma actually makes a commitment or takes a resolve saying that I recall all the lifetimes I've gone through, all the karmas that I've gone through, but when I am born this time, I will follow the path of jnana or I'll take to the path of bhakti and worship Narayana or Shiva and I will ensure that I am not born again. But when the Jivatma is born, it completely forgets all its past journeys and along with it, this resolve or promise that it keeps, that it takes, and eventually gets caught in the cycle of birth and death. As one of the listeners put it in the feedback mail that he wrote to me after last week's episode, all that we are trying to do on the spiritual path is only trying to keep a promise that we made to ourselves before we entered into this world. We are nearing the new year and it's the time when we make resolutions, right? Resolutions, New Year resolutions are something that we always do. But this promise that the Jivatma makes when it is still in the womb of the mother is the first and foremost resolution that we all have taken. So keeping this promise to ourselves should be our topmost priority in life. In the 16th shloka, Krishna makes another important point that will be pretty much the basis of the next few shlokas that we'll be discussing. Krishna says, you may aspire for and reach some higher lokas, higher realms. You can go right up to the Brahma loka, the realm of Lord Brahma. But even then, you will have to return to this cycle at some point in time. He says, A Brahma Bhuvanat Lokah Punar Avartinah Arjuna. The worlds where people exist up to the world of Brahma are bound to return. From this point on, the shlokas that we will be going through today, that Brahma Loka or Satya Loka, which is the highest loka, will be taken up and discussed, and a little bit of deeper sense of what this means, the immensity of what Krishna is saying, is going to be driven a little more firmly. So in the next few shlokas, Krishna is going to do that. When he says there is no return, it is not a simple achievement that he's talking about. But then before we get to that part, we will cover certain aspects that Swami speaks about in the Gita Vahini. It is not directly mentioned in any of the shlokas in the Bhagavad Gita, but needless to say, what Swami says is as important to us as the shlokas of the Gita. So we will, as we've been doing right throughout the series, always try and touch upon some points in the Gita Vahini, which Swami adds to his explanations of the shlokas of the Gita. In some ways, Swami, in these passages that I'm going to discuss, summarizes what is it to lead a spiritual life. We spoke about merging. We spoke about how it is a state where you don't return back to birth and death. But in this portion of the Gita Vahini, Swami is dwelling a little more on the pathways to get to that state that Krishna is describing as the supreme ultimate state. And I think that is very, very important for you and me. Instead of describing the state alone, we also want to be reminded again and again how to get that state. And that's what Swami never misses an opportunity to do. So what I'm going to be talking about in the next few minutes is from the 17th chapter of the Gita Vahini, in case any of you would like to go back and read up again. So we concluded last week by going through what Swami spoke of as Kaivalya Mukti. Krishna says this is that kind of a liberation from where there is no return to the cycle of birth and death. So at this point, Arjuna asks, does that mean that the Jivatma gets destroyed at this point? Or is there a difference between Laya and Nasa, merging and destruction. Krishna says there is no destruction, but the Jivatma of course becomes invisible. But when something becomes invisible or non-existent, that is what we call as being destroyed. How is this not destruction? Arjuna asks. In reply, Swami says, Krishna gives a beautiful analogy. And this is what Swami writes, and I quote, just because a thing is out of sight, how can you pronounce it as destroyed? No, a lump of sugar or salt disappears when placed in water. You see it no more. But can you say it has been destroyed? Or do you say it has merged? It is there. The taste declares it. It has lost the form, but it is present as its quality or guna. The soul also merges like this in Brahman. It is not destroyed at all. When the soul is not merged like this, it can at best only wander between heaven and earth, deserving life in heaven for some time and descending again to earth for further effort towards salvation. End of quote. Swami beautifully explains that Kaivalya Mukti is when the entity completely loses all identity. And when that happens, there is no return to this state of life and death. Till then, there may be highs and lows, there may be great achievements, lower states, but the ultimate is not reached of no return. Then Swami goes on to explain the four categories of people, or four categories that people can be divided into based on the kind of activities or actions that they perform. Swami explains that these are like four pathways that people take in life, and each pathway takes one to a certain destination or to a certain point in the entire journey. What are these four categories? And I think this is important for us, because it gives us a clear idea of looking at our lives, and we can do a self-analysis as to we may or may not fall into any one of these categories completely, but most of our actions, in which category does it fall into? I think we can comfortably say that primarily our life belongs to that category. So these are the four categories. The first one is karma atita or karma atita, beyond or unaffected by action. The second is nishkama karma, action without any desires for the fruit thereof, or being unaffected by any craving for the results from the actions being performed. The third category is sakama karma, action with ambition to reap and enjoy its fruit. And the fourth one is karma bhrashta, actions that know no restraint or control. Those beyond actions are whom we refer to as Jivan Muktas, the Karma Tita. The first category, those who fall in that category are Jivan Muktas, those that are liberated even while they are alive. Well, a description of such a person we have come across many, many times, even in the previous chapters, where Krishna spoke about Anyani, when he was describing Karma Yoga, when he spoke about Stita Prajna in the second chapter. All of these are descriptions of those who fall under the category of Karma Tita, a person who has completely sublimated doership, because of which no action forms any kind of stain on them, right? These are the very many descriptions that Krishna had given to people who fall under this category. Such people, Swami describes in the following way in that chapter in the Gita Vahini. Swami says, all their actions have been burned up by the fire of wisdom. Their impulses for action have been scorched by the wisdom they have gained. They have no further need for injunctions and prohibitions. They need no spiritual exercise like charity, virtuous living, or austerity. All that they do or feel or think will be divine, holy, virtuous, beneficial to mankind. The very earth they tread on is sacrosanct. Every word they utter will be the word of God, and on death, their breath need not take them to realms that are heavenly. On the falling away of the body raiment, they merge without delay in Brahman. Such are the souls who were described by me now as having absolute liberation or attainment of Brahman or instant liberation. End of quote. Very beautifully, Swami explains how this category of individuals prepare for that final moment by already being distant from body consciousness. And so when the body is given up, very naturally the individual dissolves into the infinite. Then Swami explains about the next pathway, Nishkama Karma, the category that the Gita is addressed to, or the category that the Gita is trying to push us into, hoping that we will follow it and become members of this category. Those who take to this path of performing karma without desires for the fruits, they are the ones who can be described as mumukshus, the spiritual aspirants, those who are searching for something more purposeful than the pleasures in life, right? And as we've discussed earlier, these people divert all their desires to spiritual benefits and spiritual benefits alone. They do not even prune or turn their desire for the attainment of heaven. All actions are performed merely as steps on the spiritual journey. They give up completely all the worldly motives of earning name, fame, position, wealth, or whatever it is. For one to be in this category, it goes without saying that one has to be moral, right? Because all bad karmas are naturally given up, and even good karmas are done merely as an offering to God, as we've seen in the Gita earlier, whenever Krishna spoke about what it is to lead a life of karma yoga. So Swami says that people who fall into this category win the grace of the Lord in proportion to the steadiness of their faith and practice. Faith and practice. These are two important features for people who wish to belong to this category, which applies to you and me. So if we wish to belong to this category, Swami clearly says that people in this category win grace in proportion to their steadiness of their faith and practice. The relentless practice of karma yoga and the faith that enables us to offer all our actions and duties to God and believe that He will grant us what is best for us, rather than we saying, I have done this, this is what I deserve, right? So to be able to live like that, first of all, you should be able to have that faith that God knows what is best for me. And then with that faith, we will be able to stick to relentless practice of karma yoga. And in proportion to that practice and faith, Swami says, grace is conferred. The third category, Sakama Karma, is a category that covers people from those who are simply defined as good people, harmless people, to those that aspire for the heavens and are sincerely performing some special pujas and yajnas. Probably we don't come across many such people in our everyday life, but it's a category of people who are so interested in their afterlife, what realm they will reach, whether they'll have a place in heaven. And I think this also is defined by the various cultures and traditions each one comes from. Swami describes these people in the following manner in that chapter. And Swami says, since they have an eye on the successful earning of the fruit, they will engage themselves only in acts that are approved by the scriptures. They will not do any sinful or prohibited act. They will equate each act with the merit it will confer the happiness it will ensure, the heaven it will win. Such people, when they depart from this world, will enter the supramundane worlds, for which they have sought and worked, and having stayed there as long as their merit entitles them, they have to return to earth. End of quote. So this category of people can be of two kinds. Those that live a good moral life and want to benefit from it. I think there's nothing, you cannot say anything is wrong with that, right? People who want to lead a straightforward life, people who want to work hard and enjoy the benefits of their hard work. Such people, they will not do prohibited actions. They will not try to cheat somebody. They will not try to hurt somebody. There will be a certain amount of fear of sin, right? Papa bhiti, as Swami would say. But these people are susceptible to the ups and downs of life. As we've seen so many times, the results that come to us are not completely dependent on our actions. In most cases, in most scenarios, that is what is the case. That being the case, they are bound to get disappointed. They are likely to get disappointed when their good deeds don't get recognized, don't get rewarded, or what they seek does not come to them. But if they are positive people, if they are people who still are able to stick to their goodness, they will strive more. When they don't get the results that they thought that their good actions will get, they will do more good actions. And there is these category of people, those who stick to their goodness in spite of ups and downs, are the ones who are likely to go to the next category, which is the Nishkama Karma, where the concept of or the idea of God and God's grace comes into being, and then slowly work gets transformed into worship, and that is how one becomes a Karma Yogi. And there is that opportunity of going to that next category. The other kind of people that fall into this category, as Swami said in that excerpt that I read from, are those that have an eye on the afterlife, right? They put up with all kinds of ups and downs in this life, thinking that afterlife is going to be glorious. The place that they will enjoy in heaven is going to be special, and everything is worth it, right? Whatever suffering we go through is worth it. So because their aspirations are fixed upon results still, right? They might not be fixed upon results in the present life, but still you are pinning your hopes on getting the results at some point in time, in this life or after this life. In both cases, Swami says that they might reach that heaven that they have aspired for, but they will fall back into earth and get caught up in this birth and death after briefly enjoying the benefits of heaven. In the 16th shloka, Krishna spoke about all these people, right? Because he said, right up to the Brahmaloka. They may go right up to the Brahmaloka, the loka of Lord Brahma, also referred to as Satyaloka, but they will have to come back at some point in time. Kaivalya that Krishna speaks about is like that escape velocity, right? When you're trying to launch your rocket, until you breach the gravitational forces, you may go very, very high, but you will have to fall back down because the gravitational force is going to pull you back. If you want to not be pulled back, you will have to have that escape velocity to transcend the pull of gravity, transcend this pull into the cycle of birth and death. And that is what is referred to as probably Kaivalya is not the escape velocity. The sadhana is the escape velocity that is required when you reach beyond the gravity. I think that is better described as Kaivalya. The final category that Krishna spoke about, Swami spoke about in Krishna's words in the Gita Vahini, the fourth from which certainly all of us must keep away, must rise, is Karma Bhrashta. Swami describes people who fall into this category in this manner. Swami says, and I quote, "The fourth group is not guided by any rule of conduct. They have no norms, no discrimination between virtue and vice, right and wrong, proper and improper. They have no horror of hell, no concept of heaven, no dread of the devil, no reverence for God, no respect for the scriptures, no vision of dharma. They are best pictured as beasts in human form. The majority of humans are members of this unfortunate group. They strive for momentary pleasures, short-lived happiness, temporary joy, and the evanescent comfort. To call them apes with human physique would be a big mistake, for the ape only jumps from branch to branch or from tree to tree. It releases itself from one branch or tree before landing on another. But people of this category are more like caterpillars, which move from leaf to leaf, fixing their foreparts on a new leaf before releasing their hind parts from the leaf on which they were resting until then. That is to say, by their acts in this life, people decide on their next birth, where and how it will be, even before leaving this world. The new place is ready for them. Their foreparts are already there. It is only after settling this that they relieve themselves of the hold on this world. Such people move around in the wheel of birth and death. End of quote. Swami gave a graphic example, a graphic analogy there to describe people who belong to this category. They are like caterpillars that latch on to the next leaf before letting go of the leaf they are on. The karma bhrashtas are constantly performing actions whose consequences are molding that next life that they are going to go into. So that next life, with its pains and troubles and tests, and the consequences of the actions that they have performed, is already getting ready even as they are about to leave this body. So with every wrong act, they are already fashioning and assuring themselves of their next birth. So from this description, the whole idea of a spiritual life is, I think, laid out before us. Firstly, we must raise ourselves from the last category of karma bhrashtas. We should ensure that no karmas that we perform can be put under this category. We must stop leading meaningless and purposeless lives that are only meant for pleasures and comforts. Acting without any fear of sin or acting without love for God, all of that becomes actions that fall under the category of karma bhrashta. This is what Swami would repeatedly say is an animal existence, an animal life in a human body. If we belong to the third category of those that perform sakama karma, those who do lead a moral life, they do the right things, they have fear of sin, they have love for God, they have an idea of heaven, they have idea of karma, they know that whatever I do is going to come back to me. If we happen to belong to this category of those that perform sakama karma, then we must slowly begin practicing nishkama karma. At least a few of our actions should begin to fall under this category. We should start performing them this way. I would often think Swami instructs all of us to do seva only for this purpose. When we go out and do seva, when we go out and do some poor feeding or helping some people who are in need, at least those few acts we do will be without expecting anything in return from the person we are serving, isn't it? Of course, when we're doing seva, we might seek Swami's grace in return. But definitely we will not expect anything from the person we are serving, isn't it? So through such acts of selflessness, we are slowly pushing our karmas into the realm of nishkama karma, where we are saying, Swami, I have done the act. Maybe you have not yet given up the desire for the consequences, but now you look to God and say, Swami, I have done this act, I offer it to you. If you want to give me grace in return, I will accept it from you, right? So slowly we are moving regular karmas into the realm of karma yoga. We are converting our regular work into worship. And when we do certain acts of seva like this, that attitude that we develop while doing seva will start permeating into all the other activities that we do. That attitude of selflessness will start becoming the attitude that inspires even our karma which we perform towards our family, towards our duties and responsibilities, right? And as Swami said in the Gita Vahini, as per the practice and faith, the Lord will reward, right? And the reward is jnana. When one totally sublimates doership and lives like a, I think the analogy was given in the Gita itself, the droplet of water on a lotus leaf, completely detached from the consequences, the grace comes to that person in the form of jnana, and one is lifted to that state of karmatita, where no action is performed with any amount of individuality or ahankara. The other critical thing before we move ahead is, when we are in the category of sakama karma, there is always the danger of slipping down to the fourth category when disappointments come to us in life. When there is desire for something material, there is always a danger of sorrow striking. And when inflicted by sorrow, one may either develop vairagya and strive to understand the purpose of life, in which case one goes to the next category, or one might give up striving in the right direction and take to wrong means. And I think going back and forth between these two categories for many lifetimes, one slowly becomes a true mumukshu and then moves forward to the category of nishkama karma, and then strive to go to the state of karma atita. And to show how immense is this achievement of such an individual, whom Krishna referred to as a Mahatma in the previous verse, Krishna is going to explain it in a kind of a relative way. He had said, even if you go up to Brahmaloka, you will have to return to the cycle of birth and death. Now Krishna is going to explain what that means. What is this idea of Brahmaloka? And what is the immensity of the statement that even if you go to Brahmaloka, you'll have to come and back into this cycle of birth and death. So we'll go to the next shloka where Krishna speaks about this. This is the 17th shloka. After we listen to the shloka, I'll give you a brief meaning and then we will discuss in detail.
Sahasrayuga pariyantam ahariyat brahmano viduhu ratrim yuga sahasrantam teho ratra vido janah.
Those who know the day of Brahma as comprising of 1,000 yugas and the night also having 1,000 yugas, those men who know the day and night of Brahma. So here Krishna says that those who know the day and night of Brahma know that the day comprises of 1,000 yugas and the night comprises of 1,000 yugas. Krishna speaks here of the nature of time and its relative value to earth years. He had spoken about going to the Brahmaloka, and even then one has to return to the birth and death cycle. And when we speak of Brahma, as I mentioned even last time, this is the deity Brahma, who is considered as the father of creation, Lord Brahma. Now according to the scriptures, this entire creation as we see it is a projection of Brahma's mind. Every night when we go to sleep, our universe, the entire universe that we interact with, dissolves into nothingness when we go into deep sleep. All my pains, my joys, my achievements, I'm a boss, I'm a beggar, I'm a failure, I'm a spiritual person, all these ideas are dissolved into nothingness when we go into that deep sleep state. And when I wake up, my world wakes up with me or comes back into existence. In the same way, this entire creation, this manifest world, is considered a vision of Brahma. When he is awake, it exists, and when he sleeps, it dissolves into nothingness. And within this vision, we are living our life of being born and dead a million times, taking various forms, right from the plant to the animal to the human form. But through sadhana, one can raise oneself to higher planes of existence where time dilates, right? Where 1 hour or a day in some of these planes of existence is equivalent to many, many years in the earthly plane. If you've seen the movie Interstellar, a very interesting movie that came a few years ago, you will be familiar with this concept of time dilation, where they describe how high gravity begins to dilate time, and planets that are closer to a black hole, which are typically very, very highly dense phenomena that happen in the universe, time dilates, and spending 1 day on planets which are closer to the black hole or any such high gravity entities in space is equivalent to spending many, many years on Earth. So if there were beings on that planet, their lifetime would be several hundred Earth years. When we speak of various lokas, the scriptures speak of a concept that is very similar to this. I'm not equating that to this and saying it is the same. I don't know for sure, but there is a clear parallel between what the scriptures say and what science speaks of as time dilation, right? And the great rishis seem to have understood this concept of time dilation much before science and astronomy was advanced, in the modern sense. And each higher plane that we are talking about dilates time to a different extent. One very famous example that you can find in the epics, in the epic of Mahabharata itself, from where the Bhagavad Gita is the story of King Muchukunda. This is a king who is supposed to be an ancestor of Lord Rama from the Treta Yuga. He is requested by the Devas to fight on behalf of them in a battle between the Devas and the Asuras, the gods and the demons. And at that point, they don't have a commander-in-chief, and King Muchukunda is known for his valor in the battlefield. So he's requested to take part in this battle and lead the army, and that's what he does. And King Muchukunda spends almost an entire year playing the role of commander-in-chief for the Deva army. And at the end of it, the battle is won. He goes back to Indra, the lord of the Devas, and he realizes that the gods tell him that, you know, 1 day that you spend here on earth, on heaven, is equal to many, many years on earth. And I think the actual is each day spent on heaven is equal to 1 year on earth. So he spends one entire year in the heavens, and 365 years have gone past in the earth. And they tell him, all your children and grandchildren have forgotten you, your kingdom is changed, and so there is no point in you going back, and you've done a great sacrifice to, you know, fight on our behalf and help us. So whatever boon you want, you ask us, we will give you. And it is said that King Muchukunda asks for the boon of sleep, the ability to sleep without a break for many, many years, because that entire year he does not sleep and he fights the battle. So he's blessed with that sleep, and he's given the boon that whoever disturbs his sleep, when King Muchukunda casts his eye on that person will be reduced to ashes. And that's how Krishna uses this boon to destroy Kalayavan, a king, a very wicked king who tries to conquer Mathura. And thereafter, of course, Krishna leads King Muchukunda to a spiritual life, asks him to perform tapas so that he can reach moksha. So there are many, many such stories which speak of this time dilation that happens in these various realms. Coming back to this shloka that we just heard. Here Krishna speaks of the Brahma Loka or the Satya Loka, which is the highest of the planes. And here he says, what is one day in this loka as per human years? And he says, Te Janaha, those people, Aho Ratra Vidaha, who know about the day and night, Brahmanaha, of Brahma, which means those who know this concept and how time is different in different lokas, who about what is a day according to the life of Brahma. Krishna says, those who know this, know that, viduhu, tat, know that, sahasra yuga paryantam, ending in 1,000 yugas, ahaha, is a day, ratrim, the night, yuga sahasrantam, again is comprised of 1,000 yugas. So Krishna says, Brahma's one day, just like our day, is broken into day and night. This day, or half the daylight time of the day, is equal to 1,000 yugas, and the dark part of the day, the night, is equal to 1,000 yugas. Actually, when Krishna says yugas here, the reference is actually to a Mahayuga, right? Each Mahayuga has four yugas, which are Krita Yuga, Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga and Kali Yuga. Many of you might be familiar with this. These four yugas together form a Mahayuga. And the words Mahayuga and Yuga are used interchangeably even in the scriptures. So here Krishna says 1,000 yugas lead to one day of Brahma. It is actually 1,000 Mahayugas. And this is of course said based on where the other places where this reference is made in the Bhagavata Purana and some other Puranas. So four together, Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, Kali Yuga, starting with Krita Yuga, comprise one Mahayuga, and Brahma's one day constitutes 2,000 such Mahayugas. Now if we were to see it in terms of earthly years, it is quite mind-boggling. Swami had also spoken about this. The figures I'm going to be quoting now are from a discourse that Swami delivered as part of the 1978 summer course. If you're trying to look for it in the summer course book, you'll find it in chapter 3 of that book. Swami explains in that discourse, the duration of the Kali Yuga is 4,32,000 years. The duration of the Dwapara Yuga is 2 times that Kali Yuga span. That is, the Dwapara Yuga lasts for 8,64,000 years. The Treta Yuga is 3 times the duration of the Kali Yuga, which is 12,96,000 years. And the Krita Yuga is 4 times that of the Kali Yuga. So it is 17,28,000 years. So the period which consists of all these 4 yugas together, which is described as a Mahayuga, is therefore 43,20,000 years. So one Mahayuga is typically 10 times longer than what is the duration of a Kali Yuga. So 1,000 Mahayugas will be 4,320,000,000 years. And one entire day will be 8,640,000,000 years. So that gives us an idea of what that Brahma Loka or Satya Loka is like. If Brahma takes a casual leave for a day, 8,640,000,000 years of earthly life would be gone. Right? That's how immense the time dilation is when we are talking about the Brahma Loka. So what is Krishna trying to convey through this? What is the idea? Is it just to overwhelm us or is he trying to get somewhere? So for that we will listen to the next shloka and we'll see what Krishna is saying. This is the 18th shloka of the 8th chapter.
Avyaktadvyaktaya sarvaha prabhavantyaha ragame रात्र्यागमे प्रलीयन्ते तत्रैवाव्यक्तसंज्ञके.
With the coming of day, all manifested things emerge from the unmanifest, and when night comes, they merge in that itself, which is called unmanifested. So that's the 18th verse. After having described the day of Brahma in earthly years, Krishna now explains what is the relationship between Brahma's day and night and our lives. What I had briefly mentioned while discussing the previous shloka itself, Krishna says, avyaktat, from the unmanifest, vyaktayah sarvaha, all that is manifested, prabhavanti, proceed, ahara agame, at the coming of day. Ratryagame, at the coming of night, praliyante, they dissolve. Where and what does it dissolve into? Tatra eva, verily in that, avyakta sanyake, which is called the unmanifest. So what Krishna is describing here is the cycle of creation and destruction. And this period of 1,000 Mahayugas is what is referred to as one kalpa, which is one day of Brahma. So just like it happens to us every day, when we go to sleep, our entire world dissolves into nothingness and it is recreated when we awaken the next day. When the next day comes, ahara agame, all that we call creation, the world that we interact with, the universe as it were, comes to be manifested from the unmanifest. Avyaktat vyaktayah sarvaha prabhavanti. So when we talk of the entire creation as we see it, as being a vision of Lord Brahma, when he awakes during his day, all of this comes into manifestation from the avyakta, from the unmanifest state. I think we had already come across this word avyakta before. The absolute Brahman is referred to as avyakta, the unmanifest supreme. But here avyakta is being used only in relationship with Lord Brahma's sleep. The Brahman is beyond even this, as Krishna is going to explain using the same word avyakta itself. So this avyakta should not be confused with that supreme Brahman. So this is one day of Brahma, and as long as we exist in any plane lower than the Brahmaloka, we will all dissolve into nothingness when this kalpa ends at the time of dissolution, or what is referred to as pralaya. And that is what Krishna makes even more clear in the next shloka. We'll quickly go to the next shloka, we'll listen to that also, and then we will get an idea of what Krishna is trying to convey through these shlokas.
Bhutagramah sayevayam bhutva bhutva praliyate ratryagame vashah partha prabhavatyah ragame.
O Partha, after being born again and again, that very multitude of beings disappears in spite of itself at the approach of night. It comes to life at the approach of day. So that's the 19th verse of the 8th chapter, and Krishna explains how this dissolution is inevitable and being reborn is also inevitable. Bhuta gramaha, the multitudes of beings, sa eva ayam. The usage of this phrase means that same set of beings, bhuta gramaha, multitude of beings, sa eva ayam, the same set of beings, these multitudes, bhutva bhutva, being born again and again, praliyate ratryagame, they dissolve at the coming of night, avashaha, helplessly, whether they want it or not, without taking their permission, so to say. So he says, bhutva bhutva praliyate ratryagame avashaha, helplessly they are destroyed after being born again and again when the kalpa comes. Partha, O Arjuna, Prabhavati, and they come forth aharagame, at the coming of the day, which means when the next kalpa begins. Krishna makes it very clear that the same set of beings keep coming again and again, which means there is no escape from karma. If I get dissolved at the time of pralaya and I'm again created when the next round of creation takes place, there must be some continuity that makes me come again. Otherwise, it'll be like I picking up a palmful of water from the ocean, pouring it back, and then picking up another palmful. Right? Can I say with guarantee that I'm picking the same molecules of water that I picked the first time? Once I pour them into the ocean, they kind of mix with the ocean and there's no way I'm going to be able to collect the same molecules again. But in this case that we're talking about, the manifestation and dissolution that Krishna is speaking about of what happens at the end of a kalpa is not of that kind. The karma, and through that, the individuality is kept intact. And that is why he says, the same set of beings, eva ayam, bhuta gramaha, the same set of multitude of beings are born again. When I sleep and I wake up, yes, during the sleep, the state of the world vanishes for me. But when I wake up, I can pick up from where I left off, isn't it? There is no break in continuity. Similarly, though there is a dissolution of creation when Brahma's night comes, all karmas are kept in a state of suspended animation in the avyakta phase, and they spring forth when the day of Brahma begins. So I might gather enormous good karma and even become probably the greatest of rishis, but if I have not attained that Kaivalya Mukti, I will again be thrown into the fray. I will again be brought into this cycle of being born and being dead again. So though Krishna doesn't mention it clearly in this shloka, this entire explanation of time and Lord Brahma are given in some of the Puranas, as I just mentioned. What happens when one reaches the Brahma Loka? Right? These are all lokas created by Brahma. And that has this period, this enormous period, which we refer to as a kalpa, 1000 Mahayugas. If you are in any loka created by Brahma, this will be your fate. But if you reach Brahma Loka, and if you're able to sit beside Brahma when he's sleeping and when he's waking up, I know that what I'm saying is ridiculous, but just putting it that way, we saw that 8,640,000,000 years make one day of Brahma. It is said that the lifetime of Brahma is 100 years. You can then calculate that number, that figure that I told you, into 365 into 100. So you may probably not be dissolved every time Brahma sleeps, but when the life of Brahma ends, then the Brahma Loka also will dissolve with it, and that time you will lose your position and then you will again come back into this birth and death. So even though we are speaking of periods of time that are way beyond our comprehension itself, it is still not eternity, right? That is the most important point that is being made here. You may speak of trillions and trillions of years, but it is still not eternity. You will still have to come back at some point. And when this description is given, we cannot say, oh, then everything will one day get dissolved, so you know, why bother about working towards liberation? Let's enjoy life. When the kalpa ends, I will anyway be thrown back again inside and I have to start all over again. It's like, you know, playing a game of dice or playing a game of chess, only till a certain point when everything is going to be disturbed and then you're going to start the game all over again. That is not the case. At some point, one has to turn to the spiritual path and seek the Lord to put an end to this meaningless cycle. The only escape from this cycle is that effort which will take you towards Krishna. As Krishna said in the 16th verse, Mam upetya tu kaunteya punarjanmam na vidyate. But, O Arjuna, whosoever comes to me, for him or her there is no rebirth. So the only escape from this cycle, when the kalpa ends, you might get another lifetime, you might get another form. Probably you will have to start all the way from a mineral, from a plant, who knows. And this is going on endlessly over and over again. The only escape is to reach the Lord. And to achieve this, we have one precious tool in our hands right now. You have it with you, I have it with me. Recollect this entire cycle of time we just spoke about. We don't know how many billions of years we've been going and coming and going and coming through this. And I am telling you that you have with you a tool that can help you break free from this bondage of many million or maybe billion years that has held you captive. Imagine you are chained up. Let's say for many decades you are put in confinement, somebody has imprisoned you and chained you up. And I come and tell you, you know what? You have a key that can unlock these chains, and that key is in your pocket. What will you do? What will your response be? What will my response be if somebody tells something like that? Will I waste any more moments? Will I not immediately look for that key and free myself? In the same manner, we have a very precious tool with us to break the cycle of many, many million, billion, trillion years. What is being said in this portion is, only the Lord is Satya. Everything else is nothing but Mithya, right? Unreal. This concept of Mithya is very interesting. We've discussed it earlier too in this series. That which is unreal, but which appears real, right? When you're interacting with it, it appears real, but it is actually unreal. Mithya. Something that appears real for a short time, but in reality, it does not have a true existence. So something that exists only for a short time and which does not persist is Mithya. In the same manner, existence in some higher realm may last a billion years, but still at some point it will come to an end, and hence it is Mithya. So what is defined as Mithya? What was there and is not there now? Or what will be there tomorrow, but it is not there now? Isn't it? That's what is Mithya. Something that has a limited, which has a start point and an end point. That is what is Mithya. So yesterday is Mithya, tomorrow is Mithya. Looking at it this way, only the present moment is Satya. And this present is with each one of us. Yesterday is not there today. Tomorrow is not there today. But today is there. Now is there with us right now. The present is right now here, and it is real. That present is the key to unlock ourselves. Forget about the yugas, mahayugas, kalpas, mahakalpas. We have this moment with us. The next moment, we have that moment with us. And the next moment, after that, we have that moment with us. But we can be sure only of this moment. We cannot be sure even of the next moment. The next moment, I am not sure what will be my state. So that is Mithya. Only this present moment, right now, that alone is Satya. That's why Swami would say, this is no ordinary present. It is omnipresent. Because in every now is the seed of eternity. And when we talk about nishkama karma, it is all about making this moment perfect, isn't it? Not thinking about what will I get, not thinking about what I got, not thinking about where this will take me. Nishkama karma is nothing but making this now perfect. What am I supposed to do now? Let me do it perfectly. Not bothering about what is coming tomorrow. And what makes the present perfect in all its sense is love. If you truly look at it, what is true love? True love is to love without absolutely no expectations. So every moment that we have spent in our life purely inspired by love, that moment has become perfect, and it is perfect for eternity. Can you go back and change a moment that you have already lived perfectly? Every moment in our life that we have lived perfectly has been finished. It is over. It is perfect as it is. Every moment in our life that we fill with love, that moment is perfect. Because we do things without any expectations. We do things perfectly when we are in love. We do things without wanting any reward in return, isn't it? Every moment that is spent loving God is a moment spent perfectly, spent completely, and spent wholesomely. The question is, how many such moments can we string together in this life? And when that becomes our nature, that every now I am able to live perfectly, I think the key has been used, the chains have been unlocked. So with that thought, dear listeners, I'll take leave of you. I most humbly offer this at Swami's lotus feet, and with the prayer that he empowers us to make this now count. I take leave of all of you. I'll meet you all again next week for what would be the last segment of 2020, last episode of 2020. I'll meet you next Thursday at 10 a.m. as always for the resumption of the Triune Pilgrimage. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment. Outside, inside, deep inside. Till I meet you next week, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.